Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are taking a look at two more deities from the Celtic Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, which really means that we're taking a look at two more characters from medieval Irish literature, and in particular, at the epic The Battle of Moytura, which we've had reason to talk about in the past. Let's start with Gwyfnir, the god of smiths, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, but I think I've said it like 10 times, I've edited them out by now, but that's as close as I can get. Anyway, the nice thing about this deity, he's also called Gobanus on the continent, so in Gaul, and Govanan in the Mabinogion, and they're all derived from a word that just seems to mean smith, which may in turn derive from a word that means fire, or maybe a word that means clever. But anyway, he does seem to have an association with not just smithing, but hospitality, that he's the guy who provides feasts for the Tuatha Dé Danann. And I don't know, is that an association between kind of forge fires and hearth fires that goes into this deity? Or are we looking at yet another case where these deities are often thought of, you know, less as... When we come back and look at them, we're taking these characters who are being presented as sort of superheroes and thinking of them as gods. And we're assuming that because they're gods, they have to inhabit a particular symbolic realm. They have to be the god of something. But that's not really the tack that the literature is taking. They are presented as characters. So it may just be that it is a trait of Gwyfnir's character that he is hospitable. I do think that this is a fun association to have in a role-playing game. It's nice to have characters who are concerned with things like feasting and hospitality. Those are things that were very important to ancient and medieval cultures, but which don't turn up as much in role-playing games, although I think they really add an interesting aspect. When I ran my Glorantha game, hospitality and demonstrating social status through hospitality were very important aspects of it, and the characters spent a lot of time securing their supplies of elite foodstuffs and gifts and wine and other things to make sure that they could be seen as, or at least that the one kind of politically active character could be seen as, the kind of open-handed, generous host that a nobleman within that culture is supposed to represent. Anyway, Gwyfnir's role is to be pretty much what you'd expect from the blacksmith of the gods. Like all the other, well, many of the other Tuatha Dé Danann, there's a bit in the Second Battle of Moytura where he has to sort of explain what he will do during the battle, right? Like, Lu basically goes down the list of all the various characters and says, and you, what will you do in the battle? And we've already heard about Dian Kecht's role in the battle and about the Dagda's role in the battle. And so when he asks Gwyfnir, he says that even if the battle lasts for 7 years, he will be able to fix all the spears and swords that are broken every day, and that no spear that he forges could miss its target, and that no skin it pierces shall taste life afterward. And then he ends this with a slam on his professional rival, Dol, the Fomorian smith. And he's like, yeah, that guy hasn't been able to do this. So we see a little bit of the sort of professional pride that we also saw in Dian Kecht when we talked about him. Now, there's a bunch of stuff in Deities and Demigods about how, you know, Gwyfnir produces magical amulets and he produces magical weapons. There's some limitations on these, and that makes sense from a gameplay perspective because essentially, in the legend, he's saying that the weapons that he produces are unstoppably great, but obviously for game purposes, you don't really want that. You want them to have some kind of limitations on them, so it says they always hit their target, but if you try to do something impossible with them, the god will actually punish you. So, you know, if you get cocky and you're like, oh, I'll hit that guy with my axe, and the DM goes, well, he's 100 feet away, and you go, oh, hey, smith god, I thought you said that it never misses. You're like, well, okay, I'll hit the guy, but then I will strike you with lightning for basically daring to test my divine skill. That's fine, that's whatever, but I think, you know, a lot of the time I talk about the experience of playing a cleric or paladin of one of these deities, and I actually don't think that's really the ideal role for this one, I think he's much more likely to go into your game's mythology as the creator of particular magical items or magical weapons. In fact, you could say that that's what magical weapons are. If ever you just have like a plus one sword or something like that, which I don't recommend, but if ever you do have a plus one sword, that's where it came from. It came from the forge of the God of Smiths, which is pretty cool, and would explain why, you know, magical swords tend to have certain similar characteristics. I've always been of the opinion that magic weapons should be relatively rare, or at least that they should have exciting backstories. In my D&D game, one of the NPCs had this flaming sword, and the backstory for this, and for all flaming swords carried by people in her culture, was that they, you know, if someone's been murdered, and a member of their family who decides to be their avenger goes and takes their sword from off their funeral pyre. And if they really have been killed unjustly, then the sword will just keep burning and won't go out until the person who slew them has been killed in turn. Anyway, he seems to have been pretty important. He's a patron of Smiths, and Smiths are seen as, you know, high status people, people who are learned and who are important to the economy of the community. He's often described as one of a group of wise gods, or gods who have particular skills, sometimes also including Dean Kecht. Other than the thing about being a guy who provides feasts and has a magic cow, a lot of magic cows in Irish mythology, other than that, he's pretty much what you'd expect from a god of Smiths, given the particular status of Smiths in this society. But a character who is not what you would expect is the next entry on the list, and that is Lu. And I feel like the book's read on Lu is very weird. To explain why, let's take a look at the context of Lu in the mythological cycle. So Lu is basically a hero character. He is the child of one of the Tua Dedannan and a Fomorian, and he has a whole bunch of childhood adventures and what have you, which are different in different sources. He turns up to visit the Tua Dedannan, and he says, you know, I want you to accept me among your company. And they say, okay, well, anyone who wants to be one of us has to have a particular skill. And he says, well, I'm a harpist. And they go, no, we got a harpist. And he goes, okay, well, I'm a smith. No, we got a smith. He goes, well, I'm a champion. No, well, we have a champion. And so on and so forth until the end. He says, okay, but look, do you have anyone who can do all of these things? And they're forced to admit that no, they don't. So Lu is just this guy who's great at everything. He, you know, he's a shining youth with great parts. And the Second Battle of Mashura calls him the Gifted Youth, you know. And when he arrives, he thinks, you know, oh, it's weird that the Tua Dedannan are taking this oppression of the Fomorians and they're putting up with it. But of course, what they're waiting for is a leader to lead them out of their oppression, and that leader is Lu. Because he's good at everything, they value his knowledge very highly, and actually initially in the Battle of Mortura, they don't want him to participate because they're afraid that he'll die. And when he dies, you know, it's not just that he will die, but that all of his knowledge will be lost. But nonetheless, he gets involved in the fight. The description of him in Deities and Demigods says that he's a large man with large hands, which I think is based on one of his epithets. He's called Lu of the Long Arm. But I think that this is intended to reflect, like, his prowess in combat. You know what I mean? Like, that he'll hit you with his spear, even if you think that you're further away than he could reasonably hit. Like, he's Lu with a long arm. He'll get you. So he's just really good at everything. Some sources describe him as a sun god, but this is, I mean, I feel like, you know, later folklorists went back and were looking for someone who seemed, you know, a bit like Apollo. Like, he's a martial god and he's a god of learning. He's more likely to be the figure that's identified sometimes as the Celtic Mercury, which again may just go to show that these correspondences between the gods of classical antiquity and the gods of Western Europe, like, are never going to be 100% perfect. He's strongly associated with the keeping of oaths. There's a story about how his father is killed by these three brothers, and he tracks them down and inflicts a revenge on them, which is all to do with the idea of performing what you promised. But he gets a bunch of magic items out of this, which he's going to use in the war against the Fomorians. Now, having said all that and talked about this guy's high importance and people think he's a sun god and da-da-da-da-da, what I'm going to do is compare this all to the Legion of Superheroes, the science fiction superhero comic book from DC Comics. Because the way that the game describes Lu is that he can mimic any one power of one being, right? So basically, he can do anything, but what he can't do is do them all at once. So he can be as good a physician as Dean Kecht, or he can be as strong and powerful as the Dagda, or whatever, but he can't do them both. He has to pick one of those abilities and do it. Now, I'm not aware that that is how Lou works. It is how Ultra Boy from the Legion of Superheroes works. Ultra Boy has a pretty good superhero ability, particularly, I think, for a role-playing game, because he'd be quite an interesting character to play, which is that Ultra Boy has a huge suite of superpowers. He's got all the sort of powers of Superman. He can fly, and he's super strong, and he's invulnerable, and yada da 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 da. But he can't be all those things at the same time. He has to know which power he's going to use, and he picks one. So he can fly, but he's not invulnerable at the same time. Or if he's super strong, then he can't use his whatever vision, you know. And that makes him interesting to play, as opposed to Superman, who is pretty straightforward to play in a tactical sense, because he can do pretty much anything. You know, if you're getting conflict in your play of Superman, your conflict is coming from the fact that, like, Lois Lane's trying to find out your secret identity, and Jimmy Olsen's in trouble with another of his harebrained schemes. So they've set up Lou as Ultra Boy, and the only reason that I say this is because the Tua Dedanan actually resemble the Legion of Superheroes in another way, which is that the Legion of Superheroes have this rule that they won't admit two members who have the same exact powers, right? That's why Cosmic Boy and Cosmic King aren't both members. I don't know if Cosmic King was ever turned down. The point is that he's a creep. It's also why, like, it's not just all Daxamites, because they all have amazing superpowers. And there are people who get rejected for having identical powers to another member. I think there's a story where that happens to Supergirl, because her powers are the same as Superboy's. Anyway, my point is just that it's really weird that the Tua Dedanan haven't figured out that certain types of abilities stack. One of the things that I've discovered in games where you assemble kind of mission teams from larger groups of character, so this is something that happens a lot in LARPs, for example, is that some player abilities stack and other ones don't. That is to say, if you're putting together a team and it has one fighter on it, two fighters is better than one, right? If there's not going to be a fight, they're equally useless. But if there's going to be a fight, two is better than one. By contrast, two diplomats isn't super useful if you're only going to be negotiating with one person. So maybe you don't need two Harpers, although I can definitely think of situations in which you would, but certainly two champions doesn't sound so bad. Like, Agma can't fight absolutely everybody. Why not have this shining youth come in and join your company? Presumably the answer is that the Tua Dedanan, like everybody else in Irish literature, are bound by a set of ritualistic codes, which they have to follow regardless of whether they make any sense or not. So how does Lou turn up in your games? I like the idea that he's a sort of god of excellence. I feel like god of generalities is a really weird way to put that. But I like the idea that he's sort of great at everything. He's a god of potential, of human potential even, right? That that if you cultivate yourself and you can't, there's nothing to stop you from being a great fighter and a great poet and a physician and a smith and so on and so on and so on, right? He's the god of multi-classed characters. Or maybe just the god of, I don't know, who's good, a little bit good at everything, rogues. I think that that's a really interesting idea. And the idea that these are characters who might push themselves to achieve the same demanding standards of their god. Now, Dungeons & Dragons classes don't really correspond to any particular historical archetypes, right? Like, we can understand that clerics are meant to be like Van Helsing or Friar Tuck. We understand what fighters are, and we have a pretty good idea of what a wizard is. But a lot of things, they're hard to make work in contexts outside the medieval-inspired but not actually medieval setting of D&D fantasy. Many years ago, there was a poster on the website RPGNet, and his name, unfortunately, I can't remember, but he was designing a D&D setting in an ancient Greek or Hellenistic world, and he wanted to, as much as possible, keep the character classes in what was then the current edition of D&D, which was 3rd. And so he was struggling to account for the monk. Right? Monks are clearly meant to be like Shaolin monks, right? They're kung fu masters. And they're presumably because somebody liked martial arts movies. I mean, it was the 70s or the early 80s, right? Somebody was a big Shaw Brothers fan. But if you're trying to have the historical flavor of a particular time and place, monks are hard to justify. And he says, well, actually, no, if this is ancient Greece, they're athletes. They're people who almost kind of have superpowers because they push their bodies to the limits of physical perfection. And I wonder if Lou might not be a good monk-type patron, you know, because again, it's got that idea of cultivating both the physical and the mental abilities. You know, monks are good at fighting, but they're not grizzled veteran types like fighters or monosyllabic face smashers like barbarians. They're refined, cultivated people who are as interested in, you know, theology and philosophy, and, you know, they'll do calligraphy and whatever. So that almost makes sense that Lou might make a good patron for a monk-type character, someone who is developing his own, someone who is developing their own potential and manifesting that potential through deeds of great physical strength and agility and what have you. I mentioned Lou's participation in the Second Battle of Mortura. Initially, the Tuatha De do want to keep him out of the fight, but he winds up getting involved, and he is, in fact, the one who kills Balor, the main bad guy. So you can see the important role that he holds in this myth cycle. I mean, he is really kind of the protagonist of it, and we found ourselves in yet another one of those situations where we have a protagonist deity who isn't the primary deity, right? So Odin is the ruler of the Norse pantheon, but he's not the main character of Norse mythology. Norse mythology is far more concerned with Thor, which again means that Lou is a great patron for player characters because he has this ethos of adventuring and heroism. You know, he grew up in circumstances, he had a bunch of villains that he had to overcome, then he came to these people who were kind of just waiting for him to arrive almost, and then he led them to victory over a monstrous foe. So it doesn't even necessarily have to be monks or whatever, but that people who strive to better themselves, to level up, to break out of their own perceived limitations, strive to emulate the example of Lou, who, you know, is good at everything and, you know, arrives in places and shakes them up, rather than simply accepting that the fate of these people is to be dominated by the bad guys. All right, so that's about all the time that we have for today. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at some more deities from Celtic mythology, including the God of the Sea. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.